C1. You will hear three recordings. You will hear each one twice. Listen to them carefully and complete the tasks as required. Before listening for the first time, you will have time to read the questions that correspond to each recording. Incorrect answers are not deducted from the final mark for the assessment of this part of the exam. Once you have heard the last recording, you will have time to complete the answer sheet. Once this time has finished, all exam materials will be collected and additional time will not be permitted. Write your answers on answer sheet 3. You may use this booklet to make notes. However, it should be noted that any answers written in the booklet will not be assessed under any circumstances. Task 1. You will hear an extract from Jamie Drummond giving a talk on the New Millennium Goals and crowdsourcing. Instructions. Listen carefully and answer the following questions 1 to 8 according to what the speaker says. You must choose one answer from the three options given for each question. Write your answers on answer sheet 3. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
So let me start by taking you back. The year 2000. The year 2000 should mean more. More than just a 2 and some zeros. Well, amazingly, for once, our world leaders actually lived up to that millennium moment. And back in 2000, agreed some pretty extraordinary stuff. Visionary, measurable, long-term targets called the Millennium Development Goals. The deal agreed then goes like this. Developing countries promised to at least halve extreme poverty, hunger, and deaths from disease alongside some other targets by 2015. And developed nations promised to help them get that done by dropping debts, increasing smart aid, and trade reform. Well, we're approaching 2015, so we better assess how are we doing on these goals. But we've also got to decide, do we like such global goals? Some people don't. And if we like them, we've got to decide what we want to do on these goals going forward. What does the world want to do together? We've got to decide a process by which we decide. Well, I definitely think these goals are worth building on and seeing through. And here's just a few reasons why. Incredible partnerships between the private sector, political leaders, philanthropists, and amazing grassroots activists across the developing world. All together, they achieve these results. Increased the number of people on antiretrovirals, life-saving anti-AIDS drugs, nearly halved deaths from malaria, vaccinated so many that 5.4 million lives will be saved, and combined, this is going to result in 2 million fewer children dying every year last year than in the year 2000. That's 5,000 fewer kids dying every day, 10 times you lot not dead every day because of all of these partnerships. Anyway, for now, anyone involved in getting these results, thank you. I think this proved these goals are worth it. But there's still a lot of unfinished business. Still, 7.6 million children die every year of preventable, treatable diseases. And 178 million kids are malnourished to the point of stunting, a horrible term, which means physical and cognitive lifelong impairment. So there's plenty a lot more to do on the goals we've got. But then a lot of people think, there were things that should have been in the original package that weren't agreed back then that should now be included, like sustainable development targets, natural resource governance targets, access to opportunity, to knowledge, equity, fighting corruption. All of this is measurable and could be in the new goals. But the key thing here is, what do you think should be in the new goals? What do you want? Are you annoyed that I didn't talk about gender equality or education? Should those be the new package of goals? And quite frankly, that's a good question, but there's going to be some tough trade-offs and choices here. So you want to hope that the process by which the world decides these new goals is going to be legitimate, right? Well, as we gather here in Edinburgh, technocrats appointed by the UN and certain governments with the best intentions are busying themselves designing a new package of goals. And currently, they're doing that through pretty much the same old late 20th century top-down elite-closed process. But of course, since then, the web and mobile telephony, along with ubiquitous reality TV formats, have spread all around the world. So what we'd like to propose is that we use them to involve people from all around the world in an historic first, the world's first truly global poll and consultation, where everyone, everywhere, has an equal voice for the very first time. I mean, wouldn't it be a huge historic missed opportunity not to do this, given that we can? There's hundreds of billions of your aid dollars at stake, tens of millions of lives or deaths at stake. And I'd argue the security and future of you and your family is also at stake. So if you're with me, I'd say there's three essential steps in this crowdsourcing campaign: collecting, connecting, and committing. So let me start by taking you back. The year 2000. The year 2000 should mean more than just a two and some zeros. Well, amazingly, for once, our world leaders actually lived up to that millennium moment, and back in 2000 agreed some pretty extraordinary stuff. Visionary, measurable, long-term targets called the Millennium Development Goals. The deal agreed then goes like this. Developing countries promised to at least halve extreme poverty, hunger, and deaths from disease alongside some other targets by 2015. And developed nations promised to help them get that done by dropping debts, increasing smart aid, and trade reform. Well, we're approaching 2015, so we better assess how are we doing on these goals. But we've also got to decide, do we like such global goals? Some people don't. And if we like them, we've got to decide what we want to do on these goals going forward. What does the world want to do together? We've got to decide a process by which we decide. Well, I definitely think these goals are worth building on and seeing through. And here's just a few reasons why. Incredible partnerships between the private sector, political leaders, philanthropists, and amazing grassroots activists across the developing world. All together, they achieved these results. Increased the number of people on antiretrovirals, life-saving anti-AIDS drugs. Nearly halved deaths from malaria. Vaccinated so many that 5.4 million lives will be saved. And combined, this is going to result in 2 million fewer children dying every year last year than in the year 2000. That's 5,000 fewer kids dying every day, 10 times you lot not dead every day because of all of these partnerships. Anyway, for now, anyone involved in getting these results, thank you. I think this proved these goals are worth it. But there's still a lot of unfinished business. Still, 7.6 million children die every year of preventable, treatable diseases. And 178 million kids are malnourished to the point of stunting, a horrible term, which means physical and cognitive lifelong impairment. So there's plenty a lot more to do on the goals we've got. But then a lot of people think there were things that should have been in the original package that weren't agreed back then that should now be included, like sustainable development targets, natural resource governance targets, access to opportunity, to knowledge, equity, fighting corruption. All of this is measurable and could be in the new goals. But the key thing here is, what do you think should be in the new goals? What do you want? Are you annoyed that I didn't talk about gender equality or education? Should those be the new package of goals? And quite frankly, that's a good question, but there's going to be some tough trade-offs and choices here. So you want to hope that the process by which the world decides these new goals is going to be legitimate, right? Well, as we gather here in Edinburgh, technocrats appointed by the UN and certain governments with the best intentions are busying themselves designing a new package of goals. And currently, they're doing that through pretty much the same old late 20th century top-down elite-closed process. But of course, since then, the web and mobile telephony, along with ubiquitous reality TV formats, have spread all around the world. So what we'd like to propose is that we use them to involve people from all around the world in an historic first, the world's first truly global poll and consultation, where everyone, everywhere, has an equal voice for the very first time. I mean, wouldn't it be a huge historic missed opportunity not to do this, given that we can? There's hundreds of billions of your aid dollars at stake, tens of millions of lives or deaths at stake, and I'd argue the security and future of you and your family is also at stake. So if you're with me, I'd say there's three essential steps in this crowdsourcing campaign: collecting, connecting, and committing.
Task 2. You will hear Hillary Clinton given a talk at a TED Women conference. Instructions. Listen carefully and complete the statements 9 to 15 below with one or two words according to what the speaker says. The wording of the sentences below is slightly different from what you hear. However, the word or words you write must be exactly the same as what you hear. Write your answers on answer sheet 3. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
There are more than 600 million girls in the developing world alone. More than one quarter of the population of Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, and sub-Saharan Africa are girls and women between the ages of 10 and 24. Now, people sometimes talk about the youth bulge of the Middle East and the developing world solely as a group of unemployed young men, and that is a problem. But we also need to figure out how to tap the potential of girls. At the President's Entrepreneurship Summit this last April, I announced a program called Tech Women to match women in Muslim-majority countries with women working in tech countries here at home. Across the globe, we have an opportunity to build these networks and to empower these women who are already taking the steps to be entrepreneurs and business leaders in their own societies. I love this story about a teenage girl and a cow, which drives home the challenge but also the opportunity that we face today. This teenage girl's father expected to force her into an early marriage, but she had been to school and she received a cow, perhaps through the Heifer Project, designed to encourage her to stay in school. When her father demanded that she drop out of school and get married, she said no. When he insisted, she insisted right back. And finally, she pulled out her trump card. If I leave and get married, I'm taking my cow. That cow belongs to me. So guess what? She stayed in school. She was spared an early marriage, all because her father couldn't bear to part with the cow. But the lesson goes beyond the human nature of the story. Even a small intervention can change a girl's life. And you, many of you here and in the virtual world participating in this TED Women Conference are already doing remarkable work. You've already presented. You already have built the networks. But we need more partnerships, more mentoring, and more good ideas. And we need to think hard about how to translate the energy and excitement in a room like this at a time here in Washington, D.C., into energy and excitement across the world. So I encourage you to seek out the State Department. We have our first ever ambassador for global women's affairs. Many of you know Milan Verveer. She and I started Vital Voices together many years ago. Get in touch with our Office of Global Women's Issues. Compete for our innovation prizes. Help us use the full power of the American government to deliver the change we want to see. Visit the website of vitalvoices.org. Or the Girl Effect at girleffect.org, or any of the other exciting organizations that you know about that are doing important work. There truly are no limits to what we can do together on behalf of girls and women. And I am so delighted that you are here, not only for this first ever conference, but fully ready and prepared to go forth from this conference to begin to do even more on behalf of your own dreams and aspirations, but also to make sure that every girl in the world has a chance to live up to her own dreams and aspirations as well. There are more than 600 million girls in the developing world alone. More than one quarter of the population of Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, and sub-Saharan Africa are girls and women between the ages of 10 and 24. Now, people sometimes talk about the youth bulge of the Middle East and the developing world solely as a group of unemployed young men, and that is a problem. But we also need to figure out how to tap the potential of girls. At the President's Entrepreneurship Summit this last April, I announced a program called Tech Women to match women in Muslim-majority countries with women working in tech countries here at home. Across the globe, we have an opportunity to build these networks and to empower these women who are already taking the steps to be entrepreneurs and business leaders in their own societies. I love this story about a teenage girl and a cow, which drives home the challenge, but also the opportunity that we face today. This teenage girl's father expected to force her into an early marriage, but she had been to school, and she received a cow, perhaps through the Heifer Project, designed to encourage her to stay in school. When her father demanded that she drop out of school and get married, she said no. When he insisted, she insisted right back. And finally, she pulled out her trump card. If I leave and get married, I'm taking my cow. That cow belongs to me. So guess what? She stayed in school. She was spared an early marriage, all because her father couldn't bear to part with the cow. But the lesson goes beyond the human nature of the story. Even a small intervention can change a girl's life. And you, many of you, here and in the virtual world participating in this TED Women Conference are already doing remarkable work. You've already presented. You already have built the networks. But we need more partnerships, more mentoring, and more good ideas. And we need to think hard about how to translate the energy and excitement in a room like this at a time here in Washington, D.C., into energy and excitement across the world. So I encourage you to seek out the State Department. We have our first ever ambassador for global women's affairs. Many of you know Milan Verveer. She and I started Vital Voices together many years ago. Get in touch with our Office of Global Women's Issues. compete for our innovation prizes, help us use the full power of the American government to deliver the change we want to see, visit the website of vitalvoices.org or the Girl Effect at girleffect.org or any of the other exciting organizations that you know about that are doing important work. There truly are no limits to what we can do together on behalf of girls and women. And I am so delighted that you are here, not only for this first ever conference, but fully ready and prepared to go forth from this conference to begin to do even more on behalf of your own dreams and aspirations, but also to make sure that every girl in the world has a chance to live up to her own dreams and aspirations as well.
Task 3. You will hear an extract from a debate program in which two people, Sebastian Coe, former Olympic champion, and Zainab Badawi, discuss the role of sport in youth. Instructions. There are 6 sentences, A to F, but only 5 have been stated in the conversation. Note that the 6 sentences, A to F, may not use the exact words you hear. Match the right sentences to the right speaker. There is an extra sentence which is not mentioned. Write your answers on answer sheet 3. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
It's having a bit of a job, really, engaging people. If you look at what the British Gold Olympic long jump champion Greg Rutherford has said, he says things have changed. He says, I remember having people knock on my door when I was a kid saying, I've heard you're fast, let's race. You don't see things like that anymore. He says, we need to bring athletics to the people and do more to push it.
And he's quite right. And our own research at the IAAF shows us that we have had difficulties in engaging with a new generation of young people. And my time in London 2012 told me that young people see the world in a very, very different way. There are many, many distractions. Their landscape is cluttered and complicated. And track and field can no longer take for granted that the motivations that got me to join an athletics club back in 1968 are the same motivations that 12, 13-year-olds today. But the one really important point here is that for all these challenges, track and field still maintains and contains all the physical literacies, all the really great attributes that create not just a sporting legacy for young people, but a way of life.
But just looking at sport as a whole, really, you need to integrate it, don't you, into everybody's world. And when you're talking about young people in particular, and you look at them all over the world, the major preoccupation for so many of them is, I want a good education and I want to get a job. We know that in so many countries there's a very high rate of unemployment amongst young people.
Yes, but that's not a proposition that is mutually exclusive from sport. I helped and created an International Inspiration Foundation. During the London Games, our challenge was to deliver high-quality physical education and sporting opportunities for 12 million young people in 20 countries by 2012. In fact, by 2012, we'd hit the target. I'm delighted to say that in the last year, independently assessed, we've now got 25 million young people around the world actively engaged with that foundation. And yes, you're right. There are challenges, and we should be clear that in encouraging young people to play sport in some environments is a really good and practical thing. Actually, there are young people in many environments that are surviving the day, but I've seen the work of our programmes in parts of the world that are particularly challenged, where sport is a saviour. Sport is the most potent social worker in any community, and probably the deftest of diplomats an international level.
It can transform lives. Obviously, you've got, you know, the stories of the rags to riches, you know, people becoming big, famous footballers, or, I'm just saying there's that.
It does more than that.
Yeah, and that's the point I want to make to you, and I say you have to integrate it into, so that it addresses people's preoccupations. If you look at, for instance, the work at the time of the UN Special Envoy on Sport, former President of Switzerland, Adolf Ogi, appointed by Kofi Annan when he was Secretary General of the UN, and he said, look, sport is more than just a ball or whatever, it can transform lives. And he gave an example of how he worked with the United Nations in Mozambique, where they set up small companies to produce sportswear and footballs, which provided employment by allowing people to make and sell these things. So he says, you see, sport is not just sport for its own sake. It also offers employment, business opportunities, and money. In short, sport can be everything and anything.
And he's absolutely right. And one of the biggest challenges facing the global community today is physical inactivity. By 2030, half the population of the USA, half the population of China, a third of the population of the UK and Brazil will be deemed physically inactive. This is costing trillions of dollars a year. Sport can play a seismic role, and does, in that environment. And he's absolutely right. You know, I've seen sport transform the lives of young people. This is far more than trying to find the next David Beckham or the next Roger Federer.
You said also it's a diplomatic or a cultural tool, and we've seen again examples, for instance, the Peres Center, set up by the former president of Israel, Shimon Peres, to bring Israelis and Palestinians playing together so that it can encourage dialogue. When we say, you know, it can be used as a tool for conflict resolution, to provide employment, to transform lives, aren't we expecting too much of sport to deliver all that?
We should never expect too much from sport, because sport actually delivers in the most extraordinary way and gets closer to many of these challenges than orthodox politicians do.
It's having a bit of a job, really, engaging people. If you look at what the British Gold Olympic long jump champion Greg Rutherford has said, he says things have changed. He says, I remember having people knock on my door when I was a kid saying, I've heard you're fast, let's race. You don't see things like that anymore. He says, we need to bring athletics to the people and do more to push it.
And he's quite right. And our own research at the IAAF shows us that we have had difficulties in engaging with a new generation of young people. And my time in London 2012 told me that young people see the world in a very, very different way. There are many, many distractions. Their landscape is cluttered and complicated. And track and field can no longer take for granted that the motivations that got me to join an athletics club back in 1968 are the same motivations that 12, 13-year-olds today. But the one really important point here is that for all these challenges, track and field still maintains and contains all the physical literacies, all the really great attributes that create not just a sporting legacy for young people, but a way of life.
But just looking at sport as a whole, really, you need to integrate it, don't you, into everybody's world. And when you're talking about young people in particular, and you look at them all over the world, the major preoccupation for so many of them is, I want a good education and I want to get a job. We know that in so many countries there's a very high rate of unemployment amongst young people.
Yes, but that's not a proposition that is mutually exclusive from sport. I helped and created an International Inspiration Foundation. During the London Games, our challenge was to deliver high-quality physical education and sporting opportunities for 12 million young people in 20 countries by 2012. In fact, by 2012, we'd hit the target. I'm delighted to say that in the last year, independently assessed, we've now got 25 million young people around the world actively engaged with that foundation. And yes, you're right. There are challenges, and we should be clear that in encouraging young people to play sport in some environments is a really good and practical thing. Actually, there are young people in many environments that are surviving the day, but I've seen the work of our programmes in parts of the world that are particularly challenged, where sport is a saviour. Sport is the most potent social worker in any community, and probably the deftest of diplomats at an international level.
It can transform lives. Obviously, you've got, you know, the stories of the rags to riches, you know, people becoming big, famous footballers, or, I'm just saying there's that.
It does more than that.
Yeah, and that's the point I want to make to you, and I say you have to integrate it into, so that it addresses people's preoccupations. If you look at, for instance, the work at the time of the UN Special Envoy on Sport, former President of Switzerland, Adolf Ogi, appointed by Kofi Annan when he was Secretary General of the UN, and he said, look, sport is more than just a ball or whatever, it can transform lives. And he gave an example of how he worked with the United Nations in Mozambique, where they set up small companies to produce sportswear and footballs, which provided employment by allowing people to make and sell these things. So he says, you see, sport is not just sport for its own sake. It also offers employment, business opportunities, and money. In short, sport can be everything and anything.
And he's absolutely right. And one of the biggest challenges facing the global community today is physical inactivity. By 2030, half the population of the USA, half the population of China, a third of the population of the UK and Brazil will be deemed physically inactive. This is costing trillions of dollars a year. Sport can play a seismic role, and does, in that environment. And he's absolutely right. You know, I've seen sport transform the lives of young people. This is far more than trying to find the next David Beckham or the next Roger Federer.
You said also it's a diplomatic or a cultural tool, and we've seen again examples, for instance, the Peres Center set up by the former president of Israel, Shimon Peres, to bring Israelis and Palestinians playing together so that it can encourage dialogue. When we say, you know, it can be used as a tool for conflict resolution, to provide employment, to transform lives, aren't we expecting too much of sport to deliver all that?
We should never expect too much from sport, because sport actually delivers in the most extraordinary way and gets closer to many of these challenges than orthodox politicians do.
This is the end of the test.